Well, good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tony Giddens, the director of the LSE. I've just nipped in here very quickly to introduce this event because it's an event of great importance to me personally, as well as a milestone in the history of the LSE as an institution. Let me first of all ask you to give a very big, well, you sort of gave one, but another very big LSE welcome to our distinguished visitor, Mrs. Mary Robinson. This event marks the inauguration of the Centre for the Study of Human Rights at the LSE. I'm a strong supporter of this project since I was involved with it since its inception. It started with a conversation, I remember, between me and Stan in the sociology department. I don't know if he's sitting here down the front, or it was about 4.5 years ago, I think. And since then, it's blossomed into a fully-fledged programme with a large number of students. And we've made an important appointment I'll mention in a minute, we already know about, to the Chair of Human Rights, newly established Chair of Human Rights at the LSE. I really feel this is a subject of key importance for the LSE. And the LSE could be, I feel, in short order, the most important environment in Europe for the study of human rights. So we've got a long way down the line. I think we expect quite a lot more expansion of the programme. And we're very happy that it's starting in such a distinguished way today. So I'd also ask you, before I depart the scene, in a second to give another round of applause, because there sits the new appointment, the Professor of Human Rights, Conor Gearty, who's moved over the road from King's College and was telling me just before that he finds it a very different environment from King's. He didn't say whether it was a better one or a worse one, but at least it's a different one. We're very, very pleased to have him here. He's going to be an important leader for the project. He's a very distinguished individual in the field. And I'd ask you again, while I leave the stage, to welcome him, because he's going to introduce Mary formally, but also give him a big round of applause to welcome him here himself. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tony. The way it's different depends on my audience, really. But it's a terrific intellectual and exciting teaching environment, and I'm delighted to be here. I am actually what's called the Rousing Director for the Centre of the Study of Human Rights. The centre itself has been launched, and what we're marking is the incredible generosity of a trust which is managed by Dr. Sigrid Rousing, which has made possible the development of the centre. The centre has 5 rooms with, I think, beautifully coloured walls, very controversial walls, and it's in the St. Philip's building, and you're all welcome to drop by and have a look and join us in what I think will be an exciting intellectual project in the years ahead. I am extraordinarily pleased to be able to invite Mary Robinson to mark the Rising Directorship. And people who come to this will know about Mary's extraordinary work in the United Nations High Commission and her capacity to be both in an international organization and yet seeming also to be part of civil society at the same time. It's, I think, a unique trick. Not many people pull it off, and Mary's brilliant success in that post, I think, shows how well she managed to achieve it. But I know Mary Robinson from her time as a fantastically successful president of Ireland, a president who made the country, of which I'm a citizen, a country extremely proud of the office of president, and who achieved a tremendous amount in that post. And even before that, I know her as an inspirational teacher of law, and as a member of the Irish Senate, and as a barrister fighting human rights cases which really mattered in the Irish courts and in Strasbourg. So there are many layers to my appreciation of the extent to which Mary Robinson has affected for the good the various worlds in which she has moved, as she has moved through various places from Ireland, through the United Nations, and now on to a new and exciting project, which I'm sure she will be talking about. Mary's going to speak for about 40 minutes, and then she's delighted to receive questions for some time after that, so there will be an opportunity for you to interact with her. So without further ado, I would like you to welcome Mary to the rostrum.
Thank you. Thank you. Distinguished faculty and students, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, I'd like to thank Connor for his very warm introduction that it is extremely hard to live up to. He never thought about that. I was delighted to take up the invitation offered by Professor Peter Townsend to come back to LSE and to speak to you today. The one thing I had emphasized to Connor was you might mention that I'm an honorary fellow of LSE, which he completely forgot. But coming back to Peter Townsend, his long and distinguished career has combined academic research on the nature of poverty with sustained advocacy of policies to eliminate it. He's been an inspiration to me and to countless others over many years. Professor Emeritus he may be, but he has not retired from his commitment to the poor and to the realization of universal human rights. As acting director of the new LSE Center for the Study of Human Rights, he steered this new academic initiative successfully to its formal launch, or the launch of the director today. He also managed to publish a major edited volume on poverty, in which his own contribution is a powerful analysis of poverty as a human rights cause. So let's salute this world scholar and world citizen, this human rights theorist and activist, and let the new center work for his ideals. The center is, of course, the result of the hard work and dedication of a team of people, all committed to a shared vision of the importance of human rights in the world today. It owes much to the energy and enthusiasm of its first director, Professor Fred Halliday, also somebody of strong Irish connection. There must be a fix here somewhere. And to the support of the director of the school, whom you've just heard, Professor Tony Giddens. Allow me to pay tribute myself to Dr. Siegfried Rausing, whom I've not yet had the pleasure of meeting personally, whose generous donation from the Rausing Trust has made the expansion of the center possible. Dr. Rausing's work in the field of human rights and her vision in seeing how that work can be promoted, not just on the front line of NGO activism, but also through education and research, are gifts both to this institution and to the wider human rights community. The leadership of the center is now in the hands of Conor Gearty. As we say in Ireland, there could be no better man. Conor reminds me that I was responsible for his first ever visit to continental Europe. That was during my short career as tour manager from Ireland for student visits to the European Union institutions. You needed a lot of stamina. Somehow, the students seemed to be able to stay up all night and still more or less stay awake during the formal parts of these tours. Thankfully for both of us, we can't just exactly recall how long ago that was. That's just as well. But since then, I've watched his career develop, and I've watched it with admiration. His challenge now will be to interest and to involve the rich and diverse scholarly expertise within this renowned school, the London School of Economics, in the programme of the centre, and then to reach out much beyond that. The mushrooming of interest in the study of human rights at graduate level in both the United Kingdom and Ireland, especially over the last decade, is wholly welcome and is actually quite worth noting. There are human rights centres also at Nottingham, Durham, Glasgow, and Strathclyde. There are centres in both Northern Ireland universities, and there's a thriving programme at the National University of Ireland in Galway. And nor must I forget the longest established, which is Essex University. And I salute here my friend and recent colleague in Geneva, I don't know where he is, Kevin Boyle, who is, I know, in the audience, but I can't quite spot him at the moment. Kevin, where are you? Where is he? Hiding somewhere. Ah, voila, down there in the middle, okay. I'm particularly happy to learn of the efforts to construct cooperative links between the different human rights university programs on both islands. Cooperation, of course, has been stimulated by the process of incorporation of the European Convention on Human Rights here in the United Kingdom, a process that will be completed, it is hoped, very soon in Ireland. These developments, and in addition, common membership of the European Union, which, as you know, has adopted a formal charter of rights and freedoms, can facilitate a flow of research and ideas, as well as students and professors, between all parts of the islands. At a time of uncertainty in the peace process, it's important for academics to play a role in ensuring the strengthening of the intellectual links between the countries. One way to do so is through joint work on the implementation of human rights. The development of university human rights programs is ultimately consumer-led. The ever-increasing interest from young people in undertaking professional training in human rights through graduate study is a way to measure the relevance of the ideal of universal human rights in our time. And I was really very encouraged talking to Connor earlier to know that there is a huge interest here in the London School of Economics. And now I have to come to a point where I may disappoint some of you who thought from the lecture title, which let me remind myself is From Rhetoric to Reality, Making Human Rights Work. I may disappoint some of you who thought that this would lead me in a different direction. Realities that I don't propose to address today, and yet which I know are on all our minds, are the terrorist attacks of a year ago on 9/11, and the subsequent attacks, including just last week in Bali, together with the Security Council consideration of Iraq and the heightened tension relating to North Korea. I've spoken before of a shadow over human rights after the 11th of September. It's a shadow that remains. Last week, Lord Wolfe, speaking to the British Academy, reminded us of what must be the unshakable human rights position. He said, and I quote, "In defending democracy, we must not forget the need to observe the values which make democracy worth defending." I think that encapsulates how we respond to the challenge of post-11th of September. What I will focus on instead is what I believe the deeper global response in an interdependent world must be. We must address the underlying and unresolved human problems of injustice and despair. Our failure to address these problems of the human family incubates indiscriminate rage and violence. That leads me to the theme of my lecture, one that was constant for me while High Commissioner for Human Rights, and which will remain such in my current work. The theme is simply described. It concerns implementation and delivery. How do we move on from proclaiming the rights of people and the obligations those rights give rise to on the part of states and the international community towards the realization in practice of those rights and obligations? How do we use the great steps that have been taken up to now, both to define rights and commit states to those definitions, into truly effective collective action at national and at international levels to secure those rights for everyone in our world without distinction? As some of you may have heard, the new work I've set out to do concerns the global context in which these questions are posed, the context of globalization. The objective is to find more effective ways of making human rights values and legal standards play a bigger role in globalization processes. At the same time, the practical focus of my current work will be on how developing countries can best be supported in building their own national human rights protection systems. But before speaking on those topics, let me raise some general points which relate to moving human rights from rhetoric to reality, while at the same time they are very much linked to global issues. My first observation would be this. If we're to move to effective action, then the concept of human rights itself should be broadly defined. We must take the Vienna World Conference consensus, the Vienna World Conference in 1993, the consensus achieved there by some 173 states who participated. We must take that seriously, namely that human rights means all human rights as set out in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, economic, social, and cultural, as well as civil and political rights. Can we honestly say that in most developed countries, this is fully understood and accepted? Can we honestly say here in the United Kingdom? Can we honestly say in the United States? Can we honestly say in Ireland? And yet, if the principle of indivisibility of human rights is not fully embraced in developed countries, how effective can efforts be to insist that economic globalization should be shaped by the international law on human rights? So there is quite a task ahead. The Universal Declaration on Human Rights, the modern root of international human rights, was intended to set out universal common standards or targets of achievement for all humanity. Does anyone imagine that the Universal Declaration would have achieved the universal legitimacy that it has gained over the last half century had it not recognized economic, social, and cultural rights? If the Declaration had proclaimed only the rights to liberty, to freedom of speech and religion, freedom from torture, and fair trial, if it had been silent on the right to an adequate standard of living, including food, safe water, health care, education, work, and housing, would it have become a universal document, perhaps the most important document ever agreed through the United Nations, the fulfillment of which is the aspiration of all humankind? I think not. It would rather have perished under the charge that the Declaration was the projection of Western values and culture on the rest of the world. Awareness of human rights ideas has been deepened in the United Kingdom by the incorporation of the European Convention on Human Rights through the Human Rights Act of 1998. As the second anniversary of the implementation of that act was marked, one of your centre fellows, whom I met earlier this morning, Francesca Klug, wrote recently, "Incorporation has not proved as dramatic or unsettling for the British way of life as some predicted." What then would be the impact if the United Nations Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, which the United Kingdom has ratified, had been in fact further incorporated? Norway has done this, and the House has not fallen down. Last May, the United Nations Committee on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights considered a periodic report from the United Kingdom. The committee was told in no uncertain terms that there were no plans to incorporate the covenant here in the United Kingdom. Indeed, the government representatives left the impression that these rights were not of the same nature or priority as civil and political rights incorporated under the Human Rights Act. The committee in Geneva duly expressed its disappointment and made some strong criticisms of the United Kingdom in respect of several rights issues, including concerns about discrimination over student loans. That provoked one newspaper in Britain to declare, and I quote, "What business is it of any of this of the UN? The organization was founded in October 1945 with the principal aim of maintaining international peace and security. A subsidiary purpose was to promote respect for human rights and fundamental freedoms. But what its founders had in mind was discouraging governments from chopping their citizens' limbs off or torturing them to death. It was no part of the plan that the United Nations should start poking its nose into the finer points of British education policy." End quote. In my view, that's a wrong but rather widespread attitude, even among some non-governmental organizations and perhaps even within some universities. Is the problem perhaps that the emphasis on the European Convention and its jurisprudence has obscured the other commitments of the United Kingdom government under the parallel European Social Charter or under the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights? It's certainly rare to find any linkage made in official statements to the full catalogue of rights and freedoms set out in the Universal Declaration. Of course, the work and programme of the Department for International Development, DFID, is an admirable exception. But DFID is concerned with the international and not the national level. Similar observations can be made about Ireland. It has constitutional language that refers to social and economic rights as non-justiciable principles. A recent Irish Supreme Court case confirmed that non-justiciable status, but made no reference to the obligations of Ireland having ratified the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. And it appears not to have occurred to any lawyer before the court to raise such arguments. In the case of the United States, the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights has never been ratified. Different administrations have consistently rejected the idea of international economic, social and cultural rights, notwithstanding that they were drafted into the Universal Declaration on Human Rights from proposals that came from the United States, and notwithstanding the key role played by Eleanor Roosevelt in the process. You recall that she was chair of the Commission on Human Rights. She was the one who said, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't want the Universal Declaration to be written in lawyer's language, or worse speak, UN gobbledygook, UN speak. If I can't understand it, how will it be understood in the places that really matter, in small places close to home? And she fought with the State Department in her day. If you want to read about that, there's a wonderful book by Mary Ann Glendon of Harvard University called A World Made New. It's a very good airport read. It's the story of how Eleanor Roosevelt and her Chinese, Lebanon, French, and Canadian colleagues, John Humphreys, worked together and drew on the universal religions, the world religions, cultures, etc., and how she knew it would not be universal unless it included economic, social, and cultural rights. A key provision of the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, Article 2, concerns obligations of international assistance to developing countries in progressively securing economic, social, and cultural rights. That provision is clearly relevant to any advocacy seeking to build an ethical approach to globalization. In summary, then, one part of the transition from human rights rhetoric to human rights reality in developed countries, such as Britain and Ireland, is to take the indivisibility of rights seriously. A task of the new centre, I hope, will be to ensure that academic and scholarly attention is paid to the national and international implementation of economic and social rights obligations, as well as civil and political rights. My second observation is that the study, as well as the practice of human rights today, requires greater conceptual and policy linkage to both democracy and development. That's hardly a novel idea. It was spelled out as part of the Vienna World Conference on Human Rights almost a decade ago. But it needs more attention from governments, from academics, and from civil society groups in both the developed and developing world. Human rights work, whether at the level of theory or in implementation of policies, has reached a level of maturity where it can integrate the insights and tools from disciplines and professions other than the purely legal. In other words, human rights are no longer just a lawyer's preserve. There's space and need for much broader intellectual and scholarly attention to the subject, as well as for integrating human rights into the practical and policy programs that seek to advance human development and human security. Significant progress has been made in this direction. Looking back over my 5 years as High Commissioner, I've seen important breakthroughs, crucially beginning with the mainstreaming of a rights-based approach throughout the UN system itself. It's also to be seen in the strong links now made between human rights and human development in the work being done on human rights and human security. I've particularly noted the way that civil societies in every region are learning to use the commitments of their governments in ratifying human rights covenants and conventions as a means of securing transparent and participatory decision-making on the whole range of human rights issues, economic and social, as well as civil and political. And in this work, I must say, United Kingdom NGOs have been in the vanguard. Over the past year in particular, I witnessed a transformation in how human rights activists, despite having different agendas, were linking their activities with groups addressing economic and social development, the environment, and other issues of global concern. This process reached new levels at the Johannesburg World Summit on Sustainable Development last month. The cry in Johannesburg of the civil society groups was, in quotes, no sustainable development without human rights. Global civil society has recognized that the path to sustainable development requires explicit respect for international human rights standards. Unfortunately, this affirmation was largely resisted by the governments present in negotiations in Johannesburg, and it was very weak in the official texts of Johannesburg. But the reality is that the debate has moved on ahead of them. In Johannesburg, the broad human rights agenda, covering civil and political, as well as economic, social, and cultural rights, was pressed by civil society as being of direct relevance for many of the issues on the summit agenda, from access to clean water to HIV/AIDS. Indeed, as I witnessed at Johannesburg, whether the topic was corporate social responsibility, ecological issues, or economic development, the environmental, development, and human rights communities have never been so joined in common mission and shared agenda as they are today. Equally important, while these new or strengthened linkages are being made at the international level, powerful movements for change are also underway at the national level. NGOs are increasingly using the tools arising from the reporting of the legal commitments that governments have made under the six core international human rights instruments to engage in a deeper democratic discourse. They're following the concluding observations of the committees. They're insisting that these be widely disseminated and published in their countries and that the government be shamed into a better performance in the future. Human rights advocates in every region are either working with their governments in preparing the reports to the six treaty monitoring bodies, or are preparing parallel, or if the government has failed to report, alternative reports. In addition, development NGOs such as Oxfam are adopting a rights-based approach in their work in countries around the world. They're aware of the human rights covenants and conventions the country in question has ratified. They know what reports have been submitted, indicating measures taken by the government, and the general comments on that of the relevant committees. And they know if there have been visits and reports by any of the special rapporteurs of the United Nations Commission on Human Rights. They're linking this information to their own development work, and in particular, to how they seek to empower civil society groups in using this framework to push for results. A key challenge is to ensure that effective participatory tools are developed through which civil society groups ensure that governments translate their human rights obligations into practical actions. This challenge is all the more complex in an age when state power is diminishing because of the forces of globalization. While few would question that the primary responsibility for protecting human rights remains with national governments, there is increasing recognition that it's essential to ensure human rights obligations fall where power is exercised, whether it's in the local village or at the international meeting rooms of the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, or the IMF. As power shifts upward and downward, should human rights scrutiny not follow in both directions? In a world where markets, ideas, and peoples impact one another as never before, has the time not come to reconsider how we think about human rights and how we develop a shared sense of responsibility for their realization? These are some of the issues that I'm planning to explore in my post-UN work. I want to make the case that because a majority of countries around the world have ratified UN human rights instruments, such as the Convention on the Rights of the Child, ratified by 191 countries, the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, ratified by 170 countries, the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, ratified by 145 countries, that they've accepted certain responsibilities, both at home and abroad. Essentially, my argument is that the binding human rights framework must become part of the rules of the road of globalization. These human rights commitments, along with legal commitments made on environmental, labor, and other standards, must play a bigger role in shaping the decisions of governments in every policy arena, domestic or international. Only then will we be able to ensure a more values-led, ethical globalization. One of my partners in this project, the Geneva-based International Council on Human Rights Policy, is working on a draft report which explores the extent to which richer countries are under an obligation, a legal obligation, to ensure that economic, social, and cultural rights are respected and fulfilled in poorer countries. Drawing on legal, ethical, and practical arguments, the draft builds a strong case for internationalizing responsibilities for these rights. In an age where we debate the intervention of outside military forces to stop genocide and crimes against humanity, we ought not to shirk from the notion that the governments of more powerful countries should do what they can to ensure that basic rights to food, safe water, education, shelter, and healthcare are met in the developing world. At a minimum, our governments ought to ensure their own policies and practices don't exacerbate rights deprivation elsewhere. And we know how that happens through agricultural subsidies, textile subsidies, and so on. As I've emphasized, I'd like to see more multidisciplinary thought and action aimed at bridging existing professional and disciplinary barriers. A human rights expert will point out that by ratifying international instruments, countries have a legal obligation to ensure that they adhere to the terms of the instruments. They will contend that civil society has a responsibility, together with other non-state actors, such as business and trade unions, to ensure compliance by their governments. But what does this mean to an economist or a policy analyst? How can the language and approach of human rights be further refined to be of more relevance to other disciplines? I'd welcome the opportunity of exploring this with you. We're going to have some time for questions and answers, and really to explore how the great strengths of this institution in the field of economics and other social sciences could be brought to bear in addressing these questions. The second area I will be focusing on in my current work is to help in a low-key way to fill a gap which concerns me. It troubles me greatly in human rights at the international level. We still don't put adequate emphasis on helping developing countries to build their own national protection systems for human rights. By national protection systems, I mean the entire institutional arrangements that function under the national constitutional and legal order to ensure that human rights, based on the international commitments of the state, are advanced, enjoyed, and defended. That means the courts, the legislature, as well as national human rights institutions or human rights commissions. It also means the educational system and human rights education programs. It includes space for civil society, human rights defenders, and support for their relationship with the formal system of promotion and protection of human rights. In the context of development, the importance of human rights and democracy to sustainable development is, as I've emphasized, increasingly recognized. Yet too little attention has been given to building effective institutions. Human rights cannot be realized in the absence of effective and accountable institutions. Where courts are corrupt, overburdened, and inefficient, basic civil rights will be violated. Where social ministries are under-resourced, disempowered, or lack qualified staff, basic rights to adequate healthcare, education, and housing will remain unfulfilled. Institution building and reform is neither easy nor particularly newsworthy nor particularly sexy. It is, however, essential. A recent report on capacity building from the Human Rights Center at Columbia University in the United States and the Banyan Tree Foundation was based on discussions between experts involved in human rights capacity building activities around the world. The report is entitled Capacity Building by Human Rights Organizations, Challenges and Strategies. It highlights many key issues which need to be addressed if we hope to improve the effectiveness of capacity building initiatives. These include the importance of education in empowering local citizens to know and claim their rights, addressing North-South power imbalances, chiefly through providing more support for Southern NGOs and deepening North-South learning, and improving cooperation between international and local organizations to jointly challenge the structures that perpetuate human rights abuses at the local, national, and international level. I plan to focus on addressing such issues initially through the framework of the new Partnership for Africa's Development, the NEPAD. Whatever reservations there may be about the lack of civil society participation, African government leaders have committed themselves through NEPAD to delivering pluralistic states with transparent administrations, effective institutions, and sound regulatory frameworks, all underpinned by the rule of law and respect for international human rights standards. That's a kind of heavy sentence way of saying there are four clear commitments in the NEPAD, where African leaders say it is our priority to strengthen our administration of justice, rule of law, tackling corruption, and adherence fully to international human rights norms and standards. So African leaders have made the commitments, but questions hang over how innovative approaches, such as the peer review mechanism, whereby governments will hold each other accountable for good governance, will be implemented. Clearly, resources, both financial and intellectual, are desperately needed if we hope to see changes. Building a national protection system must be country-led, requiring both the political will of the government and the full involvement of civil society. And help from the outside must be offered in support so that the approach is truly sustainable. My hope is that new and existing links between universities, research centres, and professional legal bodies in the North, and indeed in other parts of the South, with counterparts in individual African countries, could be developed. In this way, increased resources could be marshalled for projects to support human rights capacity building in these countries. What is clear to those of us involved in this ethical globalization initiative, my three partners, the Aspen Institute, the State of the World Forum, and the International Council on Human Rights Policy, what's clear to us is that we will need to engage a broad range of other partners in achieving the objectives I've outlined. And it's at this point that I'd like to look to institutions such as the LSE and its Human Rights Center for your ideas and engagement. Let me be provocative. While human rights centers are to be welcomed, the reality is that so many academic centers exist in northern universities and so few in the global south. The study of human rights above other areas of academic inquiry must show a concern for the inequalities that result from a lack of power and influence. LSE and its new center should look for more ways to ensure partnership with universities in the south and do so in a way which helps to build capacity in those southern universities. I would highlight the role you play in bridging the divides between human rights and other academic disciplines. In a university, much of this work is done via visiting professorships, scholarly exchanges, and teaching. Those associated with the center are determined, I understand, to make the master's course in human rights a truly international qualification, not just for human rights activists, but also for those from different international bodies, governments, and business circles. Think of what could be done if some of LSE's traditional strengths could be used to deepen human rights discourse. Whether it's through the use of statistics to help strengthen understanding of rights deprivation, comparative public samplings of opinions on human rights issues, or using economic analysis to buttress arguments for extranational obligations for the realization of economic, social, and cultural rights. The possibilities are limitless. I must say I'm impressed with what is already happening, insofar as I'm aware of it here in LSE. For example, I'm impressed with your publication, Global Civil Society 2002, and I really welcome the fact that this will be updated annually. The Human Rights Center is ideally situated to act as an educational and scholarly bridge, connecting the aspirations of the human rights community and of human rights activists with the worlds of academia, of economics, politics, and of business. Let me conclude by going back to basics. In 1941, Franklin D. Roosevelt envisaged a future where there would be freedom from fear, freedom from want, as well as freedom of speech and freedom of religious worship. Those four freedoms are at the core of a more ethical globalization in this century, a globalization which must be shaped by a stronger gender perspective. Virginia Woolf put it well when she spoke of the role of women in peacemaking, and I quote her, "We can best help you prevent war, not by repeating your words and repeating your methods, but by finding new words and creating new methods." Let me turn to another woman I admire greatly, Aung San Suu Kyi, and quote from a piece she wrote entitled Freedom from Fear, and I quote, "Within a system which denies the existence of basic human rights, fear tends to be the order of the day. Fear of imprisonment, fear of torture, fear of death, fear of losing friends, family, property, or means of livelihood, fear of poverty, fear of isolation, fear of failure. A most insidious form of fear is that which masquerades as common sense or even wisdom, condemning as foolish, reckless, insignificant, or futile the small daily acts of courage which help to preserve man's self-respect and inherent human dignity. It's not easy for a people conditioned by fear, under the iron rule of the principle that might is right, to free themselves from the enervating miasma of fear. Yet, even under the most crushing state machinery, courage rises up again and again, for fear is not the natural state of civilized man. The wellspring of courage and endurance in the face of unbridled power is generally a firm belief in the sanctity of ethical principles, combined with the historical sense that despite all setbacks, the condition of man is to set an ultimate course for both spiritual and material advancement." End quote. Women and men in every region of the world are realizing that human rights is not so much about words or rhetoric, but about holding governments accountable for the legal commitments they've made. I hope it will be central to the mission of the new Human Rights Center here at LSE to provide civil society groups worldwide with support and guidance in their efforts in making human rights work. Thank you.
Even if we hadn't known, I think the excellence of the address showed that Mary was an honorary fellow of the LSE. I think it was clear. Apologies for forgetting the most vital aspect of your CV. We have about 15 minutes or so for questions. It would be nice, and I see already a hand up, if when I call you, you could just say briefly who you are, but more to the point in a sense, whether you're in a department or if you're from outside the LSE from where you come. And please remember, you know, sort of the shorter, as it were, in deference to others who may follow, the better. I saw a lady just here. Thank you.
My name is Vanessa Redway. Sorry. And I work for the United Nations Children's Fund, amongst other institutions. I just wanted, first of all, to say an enormous thanks, both to LSE and to Mary Robinson. Oh, sorry. Thank you. I wanted to say a very big thank you to LSE and to this new Center for Human Rights Study, and to Mary Robinson, at a time when I imagine most people are as grieved and enraged at the abuse of human rights that are taking place in really every country, including our own. You are an inspiration, and the formation of this Center on Human Rights is enormously encouraging. I only have one small question, and all everybody else's will be more important. I discovered, to my probably naive horror, that the United Nations only, well, as of 2 years ago, was only spending about 2% of its budget on your wonderful Human Rights Commission in Geneva. Has that sum gone up a little bit, or not? And should we exert efforts through our respective countries that more money, very much more, should be dedicated by the United Nations? Or should we also concentrate on the national level as to what is spent, for instance, in linkage, but in education in our country, including primary schools and secondary schools? I hope that question was clearer than I think it was. Thank you, Mary. Thank you, Alison.
Okay. Well, thank you, Vanessa, for, in fact, a very relevant question to what we've been talking about. The sad thing is that the UN is marginally increasing the budget of the Office of the High Commissioner, but since it goes from such a low base, although it's incrementally coming up a little bit, it doesn't make a significant difference. What we have been able to do is persuade countries to give voluntary contributions on top of the regular budget, and in the last couple of years, the budget of the office represented 2/3 voluntary contributions and only 1/3 the amount that came from the regular budget, which is less than 2% of the overall budget of the UN. There were worries about that because there can be a danger that that money will come from developed countries. So a lot of effort was made to ensure that the circle was very wide, and I was very glad to get that the office received small donations from countries in each region, from developing countries as well, so that the idea was it's a global office serving the whole of the world. But it's an awkward position. It should come out of the UN, and if any of you can exert influence through your government here in the United Kingdom or elsewhere, that influence would be very welcome, I'm sure, by my successor and by my friends and colleagues in the office. But you're also right that it's necessary to concentrate on the national level. And I think to bring home the human rights obligations, if I could just say something, I welcomed the fact that the United Kingdom, in deciding that it was going to take measures post 11th of September, which encroached on civil liberties, formally derogated, both from the European Convention and from the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. I didn't welcome that the derogation took place, but I welcomed the recognition of the proprieties, that it was necessary to derogate, and I see that, in fact, there has been a court challenge on an aspect of the derogation since. These are all valuable tools. I'm concerned that every developed country in particular that brings in legislation which contravenes the international covenant should derogate, and one very large country has not yet addressed that problem.
Thank you. The person in the white shirt at the end there. Yes,
please. I'm Linda Quarter from the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. I'm aware that I'm saying this in an institution where the Vice-Chancellor is totally committed to economic globalisation. I'm asking you, Mary, how big a threat you think the WTO itself, and in particular the General Agreement on Trade in Services, are to social, cultural and economic rights. And if they are such a threat, what do you think should be done about it?
I certainly understand the background to your question. It's a very serious question. Rather than frame the WTO as a threat, I would say up to now, the approach of the WTO has not been to take into account economic, social, and cultural rights, except in a marginal way in Doha in relation to the TRIPS agreement. That was the beginning of a kind of entry point. What our task in the global Ethical Globalization Initiative, and I hope with a lot of partners, including, I hope, the International Women's Movement, will be to insist that we have joined up government. The WTO is representatives of government going in to discuss in the WTO, but it's as if they never heard that their government has ratified these various commitments. So it's a kind of shaping. What I'm saying is that the rules of the road are relevant. The international human rights standards are relevant to the future of the WTO if there is a sufficient civil society and business, I hope, pressure. You may wonder why I say business, but I think the business sector is very powerful. Some of it is beginning to become engaged in this. It's problematic, but it's worth at least engaging because they exercise a lot of power. And I think that the general agreement on the trade and services is a very worrying area, which can have very prejudicial effect, particularly to women, the informal sector, and so on. But I would prefer to say, let's bring this dimension very strongly in and insist that it be on the table and work from there.
Thank you. There's a gentleman in the second row right in front of me on the top. Sir.
First of all, thank you very much.
If you could remember to tell us who you are, and that allows you to get a microphone.
Oh, there we go. Now it works. My name is Jerome, a student here at the LC. First of all, thank you very much again for coming. My question is, how should the international community balance the rights of the individual with the rights of the state? You mentioned, as regards to education policy here in Britain, or a woman's right to drive in Saudi Arabia, where does the balance lie, and how should, in particular, developed countries further human rights?
Again, a good question. a good deal of the thinking behind building up the international framework of human rights was to strike that balance between the individual and the state, to put responsibilities on the state to do certain things. But in fact, the Universal Declaration also puts a responsibility on all of us. We all owe a duty to community under Article 29, which is where the business sector and others can be at least brought into the possibility of the issue. So that balance is at the back of each of the international human rights instruments, but it is particularly relevant since the 11th of September, because there is a rise in fear, in human insecurity incidents. We saw those terrible attacks in Bali in recent times. And so the question is, can we afford the civil liberties protection of the old days, fair trial and all of that? And that particular balance was addressed by the authoritative body to address it under the United Nations a month before the 11th of September of last year, as it happened. The Human Rights Committee brought out concluding observations, a general comment rather, which is their way of saying jurisprudence, a general comment number 29 on what states can do in periods of emergency or if they're under pressure. What rights can they derogate from, individual rights, and what rights can they never derogate from? So it's all very clearly set out. You can never derogate from the right to life, the right not to be tortured, and so on. But there can be compromises in other areas, including length of detention and so on. So that's part of the pressure in human rights. What is very worrying is that the strength of the human rights system is that it would be seen to apply. If it is ignored or bypassed by powerful states, then it undermines its credibility. There aren't any strict means of enforcement. The main enforcement is naming and shaming. And most of that naming and shaming is by NGOs shaming their government with the fact that they have been in breach of the obligation, maybe bringing that to the Commission on Human Rights in Geneva. That's probably the main way. But that's the essential balance that is there. Without the international human rights framework, individuals would have no protection internationally against their state. They might have under the national constitution, but the value of an international system is you have the universal standards, and then these can be, the experience of these can be shared by civil society groups worldwide.
Thank you. There was a lady at the back on that row. I don't know whether you have a question.
Thank you. Suzanne Granfar. I do a PhD at King's, actually the institution that Professor Geertje just defected from 2 weeks ago.
Tony Giddens tried to trap me into some remarks. You can't be too careful.
Okay. Ms. Robertson, I have two questions for you. Firstly, how do you see the role of the US that has been so instrumental in shaping human rights instruments and basically the UN at large? You just mentioned Eleanor Roosevelt's involvement. So how do you see it with regard to possible future bombings of Iraq, with regard to the ICC at the moment and other questions? And how would you evaluate your work at the UN altogether? Now that you're not at the UN, maybe you can speak more openly. And do you believe it was worth giving up your position as the President of Ireland for that? Thank you.
A typical King's question, if I may say that.
On your first question, I certainly agree with you that the United States has played a very central role. I quoted Franklin D. Roosevelt. His four freedoms led to the United Nations Charter itself and the commitment to work together for international peace and security, and that Eleanor Roosevelt played an absolutely key role in the Universal Declaration. And part of what I will be doing over the coming months is reminding campuses and businesses and other audiences in the United States that this is their proud tradition and that it's something that they should carry into the future. Because the real worry at the moment is, I think, really twofold in relation to the United States. First of all, there is a resistance, a stronger resistance, I think, than in any other developed country to taking economic, social, and cultural rights seriously. These are political aspirations as they see it, not rights to be progressively implemented as a legal obligation. I think the European countries have come further, but I think there is a real resistance. And it's reflected in the fact that the United States has not yet ratified any of the three international instruments, neither the Convention on the Rights of the Child, the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, nor the Covenant, International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. So there's quite a hurdle. Then on the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, when I was acting as, you know, in my official capacity as High Commissioner post 11th of September, the worrying thing is that there was a feeling that the rules had changed. And people would point to the United States. There seems to be a change there because of Guantanamo Bay and using immigration law, et cetera. So the United States has a responsibility as the superpower also that it is looked to for these standards. And therefore, it's very worrying if the standards are not fully upheld, which is why I had to express a very strong view as High Commissioner. I also, as High Commissioner, expressed a great concern about the situation in relation to the ICC. The unsigning was very worrying, because unsigning any international instrument is very difficult. And then the ICC, the International Criminal Court, is such an advance, so important in tackling impunity, etc. I'm answering your question, but I want to put in a caveat now, and it relates to now that I'm freer. In a sense, I want to be very clear that I'm not going to be freer. What I said as High Commissioner, I felt free to say, and I said it. And it was important to say it, because that's what the job is about, in my view. Now I must leave space for my successor and for the office that I'm very loyal to and very proud of. There is one High Commissioner, Sergio Vieira de Mello. When there are things to be said at that public level with the authority of the UN, he will say them, and the office will work with him in that regard. So I will not, in fact, speak out on these issues. I mean, we're in an academic context now, I'm simply answering your question, but I will not speak out on the war on Iraq, etc., for the moment, because it is very important in my view that there would be a very clear line of authority to the office which has the mandate to do that. I will answer your next question, though. How did I value the work at the UN? I underestimated how difficult it would be. I would have to say that. It was much more difficult. The office was more demoralized. The circumstances were more difficult, bureaucratic circumstances to work under. But in a way that had its own compensation. There was a great... I ended with a huge sense of inner peace and great pride in what the team of the Office of the High Commissioner was doing in our work in Geneva, especially on areas like human rights guidelines for poverty reduction strategies, the field work in Colombia, in Cambodia that I saw recently, the way in which we were helping new countries like East Timor, African countries coming out of conflict and so on. And I felt very energized because the experience was very unique, and that's why I've tried to bring it now into a new dimension. I had a good rest, or a fortnight's rest anyway, not as long as my husband Nick, who's here, felt was appropriate, but we had a week in France, and then we had a week of sunshine in County Mayo, my home in Ireland. And a week of sunshine in Ireland is like a month on the Riviera, believe me. So
we have time for perhaps two, and I've seen two hands, one gentleman, and there's another gentleman up here, I think. Not at the back, I'm afraid. Very briefly, if you will, and I'll ask you to deal with them both together, if I may.
Please.
Thank you. My name is Stephen Kuszak, and I'm a postgraduate student in the European Political Economy Transition Program. Did your strong and justifiable criticism of the United States' holding suspected al-Qaeda operatives in Cuba play a role in your leaving the post as High Commissioner? And if so, what does this say about the UN today as an effective institution in defending human rights?
I will take the second question. Yes. And I regret this probably has to be the last one.
Thank you. My name is Joaquin Fonseca. I'm a student of MSc course in NGO management. In your explanation earlier, you said that we are discussing about human rights in a context of globalization where the power and the role of states are diminishing. While in your final remark, you also rightly mentioned that to make sure that human rights are respected and protected, it's important that the governments are held accountable. Now, in this context, where the human rights infringement of human rights is not only on the responsibility of the states. For the sake of globalization, where non-state actors are also playing an important role, how would you see these two things be approached? Are they compatible still? When we see that in the meetings of the human rights commissions, it's only state representatives present, while the others are not. For instance, corporates and other entities are not present. How would we effectively hold also them accountable for the fulfillment and protection of human rights? Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, on the first question, I, in fact, had decided after the term of High Commissioner is 4 years and it can be renewed once, but to be renewed it requires a vote of the General Assembly. And towards the end of, in March of the year, when I was coming to the end of that 4 year term, I indicated that I wouldn't seek a second term. That was partly because I felt it had been extremely difficult. I'd put a lot of effort into it and I was seeing the fruits of it. The office was much stronger. For family reasons, it would have been much nicer. I felt, you know, it was time to move on. There was quite an outcry, and indeed I was quite taken aback with the response at grassroots level. And I somehow realized that especially vulnerable human rights defenders and human rights groups felt much more vulnerable about the whole situation and the framework of human rights than I'd fully appreciated. And also Secretary General Kofi Annan put a lot of pressure on me to continue. He, I think at that stage, would have wished that I would continue for another term, and I undertook to continue for another year. I was very glad I did, because it allowed me to carry through post the World Conference Against Racism in Durban, of which I was Secretary General, which had been a very difficult conference, and to carry on, but even more so because of the events of the 11th of September. So I was carrying on for a further year, and then I did recognize that the human rights situation had become more difficult, and I indicated that if I was pressed hard, I would be willing to stay on. At that stage, it became aware, it became apparent that I was unlikely to be pressed hard. So Secretary General Kofi Annan agreed that perhaps we would stick to the original plan and I would finish on the 5 years. In many ways, that may have been, in its own way, a good vindication of the integrity of human rights. I think for many representatives of developing countries, they felt that there were no double standards in how human rights is operated by the Office of High Commissioner, that if a developed country is in breach or in violation, that is also criticized, and publicly. And there had been a tendency to think that international human rights standards were purely for developing countries. So I think the sense that there is of human rights being genuinely universal and applying to both developed and developing is an extremely important stage in the maturing of human rights, and there was a very smooth transition to my successor. I'm extremely supportive of the work of the office and work closely with the office in a sense of, as a private citizen now, from time to time, looking for particular information or whatever, and I will have the pleasure next Sunday of being in Geneva and of meeting a number of my friends and colleagues, and indeed meeting with the body that is a partner in this ethical globalization initiative, which is based in Geneva, the International Council on Human Rights Policy. The question from the balcony, the last question, was in fact, I think, a very important question for the issues that we've been discussing, and certainly for my own thinking about work in the future. It is, I think, correct to say, as you have indicated, that globalization has led to the power of governments diminishing. I've heard it described as a process of the privatization of power, which is an interesting way to look at globalization, and therefore it makes it more of a challenge to the traditional human rights structure, because the whole framework of human rights that we've been talking about, the two covenants and the four main instruments, are posited on the primary responsibility of states to secure the civil and political and to progressively implement the economic, social, and cultural rights of their of those under their jurisdiction. And a lot of the work of the Commission on Human Rights, as you said, is focused on that. There is now a hugely widespread debate on various aspects of how to cope with this privatization. At one level, it is to try to get business more involved in the duty to community that business owes under Article 29 of the Universal Declaration. The Secretary General, as you know, has put forward the Global Compact. There are many who feel that that's not sufficiently strong. The body that is looking at a possible regulatory framework is a subcommission of the Commission on Human Rights. That subcommission meets in August every year. It has a working group, a very important working group, under Professor David Weisbrot of Minnesota University, and it is looking at possible regulatory norms and responsibilities of corporations for compliance with human rights and not violating any of the rights under the Universal Declaration. So that's new thinking in a way. Bodies like the Committee on the Rights of the Child are having dialogues. There was one in September on the whole area of the private sector and violence against children, and wanting to involve corporations, and they were involved in a study group. When I was in Johannesburg, I was struck by the number of CEOs of major companies at Johannesburg looking at issues of environment, but also of human rights, of economic and social rights. Then there is the problem of non-state actors. Modern terrorism does not, on the whole, link with any particular state, if we leave out the problematic surrounding Iraq and North Korea at the moment. We're talking about the Al-Qaeda-type phenomenon, groups. And that's a challenge for human rights, and one which human rights must address, because terrorism is an ultimate violation of human rights in a terrible way. And those who are strong advocates of human rights must be firm in addressing and combating terrorism, but doing it, as I quoted Lord Wolfe, fully in accordance with international human rights norms and standards. And if there is a state of emergency, complying with General Comment number 29 of the Human Rights Committee, and if necessary, lodging a formal derogation and stating precisely why it's necessary to derogate, for how long, within what limits, and then sticking to that very clearly and being monitored as being accountable for sticking to that. These are the kind of parameters that we're talking about, but a very good question to end on.
I think people here will be very relieved that Mary is continuing to work in this area, and I want to thank her for having thought seriously about the centre. And let me give her and through her, you all, an assurance that the centre will be multidisciplinary. It won't be a lawyer's preserve, and it will try and work on these rules of the road of globalisation. Seems to me what the future is. Now, I know it's sometimes boring to have to thank people and you think, who are they, and so on, but this event would not take place because there would be no centre without certain people. And we recognise Mary's personal contribution in her field, and we've talked a lot about Eleanor Roosevelt. So I think I should say that without the enthusiasm of the director who introduced us, Tony Giddens, there probably wouldn't be a centre. And without Fred Halliday and Peter Townsend, both of who are here tonight, this afternoon, there probably wouldn't be this function. I mean, I have inherited a healthy, thriving centre because of the hard work of academics who don't need to do it, who have jobs, who out of a sense of moral obligation and idealism make this school the place that it is. And there are people like Stan Korn and Christine Chinkin, aided by Catherine Worthington, who have created a Masters in Human Rights, which will be, already is, as good as any there is. There are people in the centre already, Francesca Klug, Helena Cook and Sharon Shalev. There's a steering committee. This school has been already so supportive of human rights that to come here as a rising director is to come to a place that is already thriving. And I want to just end not only by thanking Mary, but by publicly recognising my gratitude to the people who have put this place in such good health from a human rights perspective.
Can I ask you to remain seated until the party leave the stage? Thank you very much.